Hey, Avi.
Hi, Maya.
So, Avi, were you ever suddenly popular in your life?
No. Wait, let me think for a minute. No.
That was fast.
Did you ever experience a sudden increase in social capital?
Like, yes and no. I was horrifically unpopular for my entire life. And then, do you remember, I think it was around 2008, it became really cool to care about stuff.
See, now I just never lived a part of history where that was the case. I'm excited to hear that it happened for you.
Yes, yes, it did. My short young life. It became a really cool thing to care about things. And I was kind of getting into social justice stuff. And it was one of those times when I was starting to learn about helping people. And I used to get into these like huge debates in my religion and world issues class. And like people would come to watch a couple of us like just debate forever and ever.
Wow.
It was pretty fun.
I was totally arguing Iggy Pop versus David Bowie in those debates.
We lead such different lives.
There were no winners. So you were popular for caring about stuff. I love that. And then what happened?
So I decided I was way too cool for prom, and I decided I wasn't going to go to prom. And then I found out that I'd gotten a prom award.
Ooh.
Because you got to like vote for people, and people had voted for me for this thing. And then there was this huge debate about whether or not I should be allowed to get a prom award if I was too cool to go to prom. And they stripped me of my award.
What was it?
It was most likely to save the world.
Yeah. So they spared you getting that award.
Oh, my God.
And yeah. Then what happened? I mean, the prom committee obviously made a bad call.
Oh, the prom committee hated me. Yeah, they were like the very cool, popular, mean kids, obviously, as you would exactly imagine.
I'm waiting for their comeuppance in this 80s movie.
Yeah, I should follow them on social media and see what's going on. Just kidding. Let's leave that trauma in the past. But something that did happen was at graduation, as a response to that, a bunch of the administration gave me a bunch of awards about doing community service and stuff. So that was great. I got like $100, which was a lot of money in grade 12.
$100 for being suddenly popular. This could catch on. I like it. I'm Avi Lewis.
And I'm Maya Menezes. And you're listening to Change Everything, a podcast by people who are freaking out about climate, racism, and inequality, and thinking through solutions that are actually as big as the crises we face.
On this episode of Change Everything, we interview Elizabeth May, leader of the Green Party of Canada, as well as a critic of her approach from within the Green Party movement, as we consider the GPC and the Green New Deal.
Now, on our last episode, we talked about the NDP and the Green New Deal. We promised to do the same with the Green Party, so that's what we're going to do today. We're going to ask the question, is the Green Party of Canada, as currently constituted, capable of advancing a Green New Deal that is worthy of the name?
And this is a really timely question, I think, for a lot of us in Canada. The Green Party is surging in the polls, enjoying that burst of sudden popularity, and the NDP is clearly struggling. And so there are lots of progressives out there who are really looking at where to park their vote if they're not enamored of either of the two old parties. And the Liberals and Conservatives are going into this campaign neck and neck. So there's a strong scenario in the outcome of this election that there could be a minority parliament, no single party able to pass legislation of import on its own. So it's not academic to consider what is in the platform of the Green Party, like it is for the NDP, as the Greens might be in a position to actually hold some measure of power over the legislative agenda in Canada after October 21st.
Now, as of the time that we're recording this episode, they haven't yet released their full platform, but they have released their climate platform, which is called Mission Possible, and they've had their overall policy vision, which is called Vision Green, up for a while now. So that's what we're going to be drawing on in this episode. But to get us started, Avi, you got to interview Elizabeth May. What was that like?
You know, it was a lot like talking to Elizabeth. I've known her for years. She's a very accessible politician. I think anyone in the climate or environmental movements has run into her at some point. You know, Elizabeth is a is a bit like the Joe Biden of Canada. Not in her. Not no.
That's
no, no,
ice
no, no.
Cold.
I just. I no. Come on. I don't mean it that way. She tends to speak off the cuff. She says stuff that she ends up having to explain later. She's a very. She's a person who. Really works from the gut.
Unscripted,
as she is the first to say. And so talking to Elizabeth, the biggest challenge is kind of staying on the same point for a while. But I think we did pretty well. I'll let you judge. Here for your green electoral consideration is my conversation with Elizabeth May. Elizabeth, welcome to Change Everything.
Thank you. I'm all about changing everything, so it feel very at home.
Very good. So on our last episode, we asked Sven Robinson if he thinks the NDP is capable of delivering a Green New Deal that is worthy of the name. And this time we're going to explore that same question for the Green Party. So you've released your climate platform, which is clearly Green New Deal-ish, called Mission Possible. It's a 20-point plan. Some specifics we'll get into, but let me give you a chance to do your first sort of brief, high-level pitch. What is the vision?
Yeah, well, I hope you noticed that the beginning of Mission Possible says we will meet or exceed anything that civil society in Canada comes up with and says this is our Green New Deal.
You said that about the American vision as well.
Well, the American vision, of course, is very American and includes radical ideas like universal health care.
Right.
Which even within my friends in the Democratic Party in the U.S. are worried that by making that part of their Green New Deal, it'll make it harder to get it through. So. Here's the difference, really, and this is also explained in Mission Possible. Green New Deal is pitched at that U.S. era of the Depression and Franklin Delano Roosevelt getting people back to work. Mission Possible is geared at May 1940, when Churchill's about to surrender to Hitler, because absolutely none of the information tells him he has a chance, because the countries of Europe is falling before Hitler's armies. The entire British army is pinned down at Dunkirk. The situation is dire. The senior civil service says there's nothing we can do. The military says we can't rescue anyone at Dunkirk. I mean, on and on and on. The news is bad. Churchill tries to call the U.S. for help. No help there. And the miracle of why the UK did not surrender to Hitler was that Churchill wondered, how many civilian boats are there in Dover? So this is our version of that.
Wait. What?
The British Army has been down at Dunkirk.
What does this mean?
I was sort of like, wow, I thought I was giving her a softball.
No, that's such an extra response. One of the civilian boats off the shore. And like,
well, look,
who
obviously
invokes Churchill?
That's something we should discuss. The invocation of a racist colonial monster figure. I mean, I did talk about
that. Unpack that later.
Yeah. We everybody knows, I think, but it's a dangerous place to go. Even more dangerous is getting a softball, what's your big vision, and then going deep into a Tom Hanks kind
Dunkirk.
Of movie. Yeah, I know. Look, the point of a wartime civilian society-wide mobilization is clearly what she's going after, but maybe, should we do a restart?
Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's give Elizabeth a restart and start up again with her retake on what is the high-level vision of the Green New Deal for the Green Party.
So the high-level pitch is this. We need to actually think outside of status quo decision-making. We need to have an inner cabinet with all parties on it so that we can stop having the climate emergency dealt with as a political football. We need to govern with Greta Thunberg's voice in our head. The house is on fire. You don't now say, well, what can we afford? Is the public ready for this? We have to say we're going off fossil fuels rapidly. We're going to bring up 100% renewable energy to our electricity grid, really ramp up the electricity grid, ban the sale of internal combustion engines by 2030, convert our vehicles to electric so that the demand for oil and gas goes rapidly down, and do a massive energy retrofit program and ensure just transition for workers. And as you lay it all out, plus, by the way, a lot of land use changes, a lot of agricultural changes that aren't all detailed in Mission Possible, but we need to plant trees everywhere. And we need to engage Canadians at the level of, well, a wartime footing. but like your backyard garden is your victory garden. And how many trees do you want to plant? Put out a call to Rotary clubs. How many of you want to plant trees, and how many of you'd like to install solar panels?
So the mobilization feeling comes through strongly in the document. I remember when I first read it, I think it was in early June, and it was kind of like a black 20-point bullet points, you know, white text on black, which is the internet equivalent of, you know, emergency footing.
That's my premise. I don't like what our web guys did with Mission
Okay,
Puzzle
don't worry about it. This is not a design podcast.
No, hang on. The Mission Possible, as released at our press conference in May, had a 3-page preamble before the 20 points, which was a PDF on our website, but the web guys just listed the 20 points. So I complained. They put the whole document easier for people to access. Starts with a full commitment, UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Starts with, we include just transition. Includes, we must have 17 sustainable development goals achieved within Canada and globally by 2030. So it isn't just web design. The document Mission Possible wasn't changed or updated. It just was easier to find so that it was clear that the commitment to truth, justice, and reconciliation is central to our platform.
Okay, let's talk about what's in it rather than what's not in it. One of the other things that you've caught a bunch of flack for is your sort of economic nationalist position on oil, where Mission Possible says, end all imports of foreign oil, and as fossil fuel use declines, use only Canadian fossil fuels. And this is the four words that I think have got you in some hot water: allow investment in upgraders to turn bitumen into gas and diesel and propane. So that is a new investment that you're calling for in fossil fuel infrastructure. How do you square that with a decade to cut emissions more than in half and the real sense of a Green New Deal?
Right. We're canceling all, no, more than half. We have to, we're going to be, by the projections we have, we'll be out of oil sands by 2030. So we're looking at the just transition for workers. If we shut down the oil sands first, I mean, we want to find a just transition for the fossil fuel sector in this country. And we're not talking about decades, right? We're not talking to 2050. We're saying, look, if we import right now, we import a hell of a lot of Bakken shale from the U.S. Bakken shale from the U.S. has a carbon footprint not dissimilar from oil sands. I mean, the huge amounts of methane. You've seen the maps of the U.S. continent at night, and the ball of light from the Dakotas looks like New York City. So that's because of vented methane. It's the stuff that blew up in Lac Mégantic, Bakken shale. If we cut importation of Saudi oil, that also has something to do with Saudi human rights. And there's only one buyer for Saudi oil in Canada, and it's the Irvings. Meanwhile, on the East Coast, we have Hibernia, producing the same kind of crude that Irvings like to buy, but anyway, your question about the upgraders,
these are all legit art. But you're,
but I'm just
yeah, you're the, slipping the away from the tough question.
So the tough question is: are we
those
going
are
to stop?
Billions of dollars of investments you're talking about?
No, hang on.
You're talking about new investments in upgrading bitumen.
We are allowing the existing investments to go forward in upgraders. We're canceling the pipelines that are already planned. We're banning fracking that is already happening. We're canceling LNG plants that are now committed. The one thing we're not stopping that is already happening, this isn't new money. It isn't government money. There are upgraders being built. They can be completed. There are not that many of them. We can give you the numbers. There's a handful in Alberta that are now being built. We wouldn't stop those from being built because for the next 10 years max, we'd be using Canadian oil in Canada to give us some landing room for the transition for workers.
I get the economic nationalist argument, and I don't agree with it, but I understand you're making it. But
it's not an economic nationalist argument.
It is,
actually.
Though. You're invoking the Canadian oil first and foreign dependence. It's the same rhetoric we've heard in the United States.
You said ideologically, I thought you cared about workers. Don't you care about workers having enough time to transition?
Sure, fair enough. We were trying to talk about whether the fossil fuel industry is going to pour billions of dollars of new money, of capital investment, into upgraders in Alberta if you're serious about transitioning away from fossil fuels in 10 years. And I'm saying you're trying to have it both ways, and you're making an argument about ending dependence on foreign oil, which is totally out of keeping with the kind of transition, the great transition that we're all really talking about.
The target for 60% reductions below 2005 levels by 2030 pretty clearly speaks for itself. We are ramping down fossil fuels everywhere and fast, and stopping imports gives us a little bit more time, not a lot, because we're out of the oil sands by 2030, not a lot more time to make sure that communities have a say in how the transition works for workers, to make sure that we have upskilling where we need it. And most of those fossil fuel sector workers have transferable skills. We need to, we just don't want this strange thing, and I'm sure you'll agree, that it's bizarre that we have a fear factor about taking action and fail to understand that what we should be afraid of is failure. Failure to take action leaves us in an unlivable situation of real pain that's global, that's everywhere, to everyone.
So you also face a little bit of an insurgency in your own party with the petition started by Alex Tirrell, the Green Party leader in Quebec, a proud eco-socialist party, which
he's
is
not part
which
of
is
our
not
party. Yeah, we're not, just to be clear, the Green Party of BC has different positions from the Green Party of Canada on some issues.
Right.
We're separate provincially and federally. And Alex he's entitled to his opinion. He never checked details, and quite a lot of what he put on his website was simply wrong, like factually
wrong. Well, he just started a petition called greensrising.ca to call on you to renounce this stand of actually calling for new investments in tar sands upgrading.
Well, he misread the platform.
I think he read the platform pretty carefully, because I've read the same words and have the same problem.
Sorry. Well, okay, we won't agree on this, Avi. I don't agree with Alex. He misstated our position. And we're not calling for zero expansion of oil sands, zero. It ramps down fast. We don't want he claimed we wanted production of bitumen until 2050. That's not true. We have a very detailed timeline. We'll be off of fossil fuels. We have to get off fossil fuels very quickly. I am driven by this. I got arrested fighting pipelines. He claimed I want more pipelines. I would be in favor of pipelines. You have to want. So we don't agree. And he also put on the website that I'd said we would not raise carbon taxes above what the Liberals had done. Never said that. Completely not true. So there was a lot of misinformation, and very few people engaged in his petition, and that's okay. Greens are grassroots. We engage in debates all the time. It's not insurgency, because that suggests somebody is in charge. These are everything in Mission Possible came from our membership.
Well, you are the leader of the national party, right?
But I have no power, Avi. My title and job description is to be the party's chief spokesperson.
Okay.
Spokesperson. All of our MPs will always and forever be entitled to vote how they want.
There might be there might be some pernicious rumors floating around that you have a fairly strong hand in the running of the federal Green Party.
If I couldn't get the website right, I don't think you're right on that. Okay. My point is, I don't actually control how the party is operated. There are rumors, but they're not. Yeah. The title leader makes people think I'm in charge of bunches of stuff. I love our grassroots culture. My only real peer group in the world where I get together and can vent is with other leaders of green parties in other countries who have the same deal.
The Green Party leader support group. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Let's talk about ideology, though, because I think it is a pretty big split within the visions of this massive transition in a decade and the spirit of the Green New Deal, which is, you know, really lit a fire of a good kind underneath the climate movement globally. Your election slogan is not left, not right, but forward together. Mm-hmm. Does that reflect the ideological sort of diversity of the Green Party of Canada? You worked for Mulroney, famously came out of some version of progressive conservatism in the distant past.
No, Abby, I was never a member of the Progressive Conservative Party. That Minister of Environment in that era recruited me as a grassroots activist who was, if anything, I'd never joined any party. If anything, I was an NDP supporter. And I said to the minister when he asked me to come work there, since you do know I'm not a progressive conservative.
You're posing your thing as not left and not right.
That's what the party decided. It's not my favorite slogan, but that's okay. I can live with it. I like forward together. What I do like about it is I think that the ideological divides of the 1900s and the 20th century are not are particularly outdated now. I think much more of the world in terms of the 1%er one percenters and the rest of us, the elites of the world, the fake populists like Trump pretending to be an outsider, to be a billionaire, mm-hmm. to get in. I think that's the real divide. I don't think there's as much of a reason to fight out the ideological divides of previous centuries. I think right now it's a fight for survival. And there are, you know, if the billionaires want to go give themselves a space station on Mars, and yeah, I want to get a GoFundMe campaign and send them there now so they stop being in our way, because we have to save ourselves.
Okay, so if you're so this is the thing. When I look at Vision Green, which is the sort of master document of Green Party policy and Mission Possible, you have your version of the carbon tax is to refund all of it, and your tax policy broadly is for a balancing and a shifting, not an increasing of the overall
Tax
revenues of the government. So let me just give you the version that I got, which is that your carbon fee and dividend refunds every dollar of the carbon tax to individuals. So the government doesn't actually use any of it for transition programs. And your position on corporate tax rate is to raise it by 3%. Whereas what you see in the United States, where the Green New Deal visions are being most hotly debated and most deeply formulated, is like the Bernie Sanders platform or the AOC Senator Markey resolution that was in the U.S. Congress, is a class warfare, really, to get back the money that has been hoarded by the financial class and by the ownership class over a generation of corporate tax cuts. And you correctly identify in Vision Green that the tax cuts under Paul Martin in the 1990s and under Harper a decade later handed $629 billion to the corporate class, which is being sloshing around in bank accounts and on bottom lines and not being reinvested in the productive economy. The Green New Deal, dead money. So you guys identify that, but then you don't actually have a plan to go and get it back.
So our platform includes things like going after the loopholes around capital. There's a lot of capital gains to be gotten. There's going after the banks. You know, Harper gave the banks billions in 2008. We're going to get it back. There's a lot of elements. We need a lot of new revenue. The reason it's important to keep carbon pricing revenue neutral. The experience that my friends in Australia had, they had balance of power. They were able to force Julia Gillard to accept a really ambitious climate plan that she didn't support during her election campaign. So they between the right wing in Australia and Labor, they went with Labor. As soon as Julia Gillard's government was over, the right wing getting back in was able to cancel the entire climate plan without uproar. If individual Australians had gotten used to a check in their hands, there would have been an uproar. So the carbon, and I had this argument with someone you know at CCPA at the time that they graded us a little lower in 2015 than I felt was fair. Because I said, no, because it shouldn't be revenue neutral. You should plow that. I said, we've got other money to plow into renewable programs. We're going to be plowing money into renewables, plowing money into making sure we're creating millions of new jobs in retrofitting all the buildings in Canada by 2030. That's huge in terms of ambition. To do that, we do need revenue. We're also going to be taxing the what people think of as sort of benign, all the e-commerce guys. I mean, come on, they've got Amazon and Netflix and Google and Facebook and all of those.
They're not even regulated in this country.
That's right. So we have a substantial number of new sources of revenue in addition to raising the tax rate on large multinationals.
See, this is my thing. It's partly a question of political culture, like the refunding the climate tax, which is exactly the trick that Trudeau's tried to play, the carbon tax.
Yeah.
Is, you know, putting more money in your pocket. This is not the alternative vision for winning this change is to recognize that the entrenched power in the fossil fuel industry, in the banking industry, and in the rest of the corporate world needs to be confronted. And what I don't hear that in the Green Party of Canada's approach, because you're talking about shifting the tax burden, not changing it, refunding the money, and asking corporations to pay a little bit more.
We are raising the corporate tax rate. There is always the pushback, which I don't believe, by the way, that transnationals will just leave. I didn't believe it about SNC-Lavalin. I don't believe it about a lot of corporations.
Right.
But 21% shouldn't drive them out of the country. In the meantime, going after the obscene levels of profits in our commercial banks, going after the money that they were lent in 2008 to help homeowners stabilize, which, of course, just went to to additional bonuses to the executives, going after wealth. We're going to tax wealth. So we need to do it differently, which is why we think we need to express it as being on a wartime-like footing, because nothing, I mean, God, don't compare us to the liberals with keeping the same carbon target that Harper had and asking for people to cheer for them when they put in place a very minor carbon tax while buying a pipeline using $4.5 billion and then an additional $13 billion in public funds. So there's no comparison to be had there.
Well, I guess it's a question of emphasis. And I know, like, so let me see if I can ask one more question, raise one more subject that might help clarify it. So in a result where there might be a minority parliament after this election, where you might hold the balance of power, where you and the NDP might hold the balance of power, who knows, maybe you and the NDP and some very famous independent MPs might hold the balance of power. What do you see as the role of social movement actors, not just ENGOs, but migrant rights organizers and people defending the unhoused, people who are rescuing fellow humans who are overdosing in our streets in record numbers? What do you see? What is the role of those social movements in your vision of how we get this done on the other side of the election?
Just so it's clear, those are key issues in our platform. We need to declare a national health emergency for the opioid crisis. When we talk about, we always talk about how indigenous people are overrepresented in our prisons. I think the directors of large pharmaceutical companies are underrepresented in our prisons. The people who foisted these OxyContin.
That's a great line.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's true, right? I mean, it just drives me fairly crazy. So our policies call for a guaranteed livable income to eradicate poverty in Canada and globally. When I say SDG goals, we're not kidding. And the SDG goal number one is the eradication of poverty everywhere by 2030. It's doable. It needs to be front and center. So in a minority parliament, we don't, I want to make it really clear, if the whatever combination or singular party thinks it can form government in a minority, if it isn't committed with real serious muscle behind it to holding global average temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius, they don't get our vote on a single thing. We go back to the polls. No party's been prepared to do that ever. As you know, there's always a bit of playing footsie and a bit of cutesy dancing because no one wants to go back to the polls right after an election because all the parties are broke. We don't care. This is about survival. So we will do what it takes to make sure that nobody form. If we have the chance, if we have enough Greens elected, we don't compromise. And you know, when you talk about the role of Indigenous leadership, the strongest resolution I've seen in Canada on this is a climate emergency comes from the Assembly of First Nations saying you have to hold to 1.5 degrees Celsius. It's climate crisis. We have to do it. So when you look at what the role of social movements, whether it's protecting migrant rights, if you look at voting records of Greens, I guess for most of the last 8 years, I've been the only vote, but you can check. There's never been an issue or a bill where I haven't gone to those advocacy organizations and said, what amendments do you want? I'll make them. To the Elizabeth Fry Society, what do you want me to do here to make sure we protect women in prisons? To fighting against the U.S. being considered a safe third country.
When you look at the vision of how this change happens, which is coming from the wave of activism with electoral partners on the inside, like in the United States, you see a very clear expression of a theory of change, which is that movements, Indigenous leadership, define locally the changes that need to be made and lead in the vision and policy process. I'm getting that from your rhetoric. I'm not getting it from your policy statements. I don't see an agency for people and movements in the way this plays out when you get a chance to legislate.
Well, it has been there for how I've worked in Parliament. It continues to be there more so when we have more MPs and more power. I mean, look, the reality, and we don't want power for ourselves. We want to share it with exactly those movements. I want more pressure in Canada. We don't have enough pressure, particularly from the environmental groups, on the kind of change that's required. And I love working with organized labor, always have. One of the reasons why in Canada versus in the US, organized labor was on board for ratifying the Kyoto Protocol. That didn't happen in the States, but we've always had good, effective alliances with what CAW at the time, now Unifor. I still work really closely with Unifor, CLC. We want to make sure that workers are protected in transitions, and transitions in our frame of reference are like so rapid, fasten your seatbelts. We don't have time anymore for incremental, you know, tweaking at the margins of the status quo kinds of changes. And social movements are integral to that.
Okay, I've heard a call for more pressure post-election. I think that's a joint achievement of this. Let me just give you one last quote then, because Bernie Sanders' Green New Deal platform, which just dropped recently, has this quote, which I would really like to know how you feel about this. Bernie says, "We need a president who has the courage, the vision, and the record to face down the greed of fossil fuel executives and the billionaire class who stand in the way of climate action. We need a president who welcomes their hatred." Do you welcome the hatred of the corporate class?
Well, I don't like anyone's hatred, but I absolutely would like to see them in jail. Does that help? I think they're a form of organized crime.
Okay, that's a statement of class warfare. That is an excellent final thought.
And it may not be the Green Party slogan, but I am the chief spokesperson.
You don't have to check with the comms team on that.
No.
Elizabeth, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Abby.
Okay, I guess it's fair to say that I had my chance to go toe-to-toe with Elizabeth. I treated the interview as a bit of an extractive project, but I think it's pretty clear what my point of view was in the interview. What did you think of it?
So many feelings, so many things were said in such interesting orders. But what's frustrating for me about the Green Party platform is that this is hands down the most ambitious climate platform of any of the parties. What is so disappointing is the complete lack of knowledge about how racism operates within that framework, and just no justice lens whatsoever. And there's a number of ways that they really showcase this. I mean, we have no meaningful action or relationship with Indigenous communities. We don't really see talk about anti-racism work as part of a climate solution. And, you know, when we're thinking about this, I think we have to talk about what the mess that happened in New Brunswick.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Like, and the mess of reporting around it. Like, we had, like, the first initial report was like 14 members who were defecting from the NDP to the Greens, and like
then it turned out, whoops, nope, not all of them. And then the mainstream media got all caught up on how many and who and when and what,
and who said what.
Yeah, but the story was clear as day, and that remains true.
Exactly. But like, how do you stand beside a member who was literally quoted saying racist shit about what a Jagmeet wearing a turban and like being a racialized person is not gonna like do well? I like that joke you made in our first episode, like, oh, how's this gonna play out in Salmon Arm? Like, this whole thing, like, I don't know how this is gonna go.
But it's a very Canadian kind of racism, isn't it? I'm not saying that I'm racist. I'm saying that my constituents are racist, and that's a problem for the party.
And my hands are just
because that was
tied.
Essentially the nature of the quote from the NDP here. And yeah, and that is wow.
That's lazy.
And then those people were just welcomed into the Green Party, that perspective.
With open arms, like really welcomed with open arms. And then of course, like way too little too late, there's a press release that comes out from the Greens saying like, oh, we don't condone racism and diversity as our strength. That's all garbage if it's not followed up with actual action. Mm-hmm. And like, this is really tied to what's going on in Quebec, I feel. Like just recently, the executive director of the National Council of Canadian Muslims asked Elizabeth May directly in a town hall, you know, would you discourage or oppose your membership who support Bill 21, or will you actively like disavow what's going on with Bill 21, which is of course banning people from wearing religious garb as public servants. And Mustafa Farouk asked this question of her, and she basically did the whole like, I'm just the spokesperson, like I couldn't force anybody to make any hard decisions, you know, like if people need to represent their constituents. This is like cowardly, and for a party on the rise, that's a very dangerous position to hold.
I think it goes to something I was trying to get out in the interview, and I don't think we really landed it, is, you know, parties that do have a sense of accountability towards communities feel internal pressure, not just elite pressure or media pressure, but actually feel it internally if they don't get something right. And I think we really struggle with that in Canada across the board, but particularly the Green Party doesn't have, and I think Elizabeth wasn't able to really clearly articulate what a relationship with communities actually feels like from inside the political machine. And she's been inside for a really long time. She's the longest standing federal leader, you know. But I think it is possible for politicians to really clearly paint a picture of what accountability to communities and to social movements looks like. And I go back to the stuff in the United States, which is the high watermark, as we've been talking about since our first episode of Change Everything. What is the high watermark for what a Green New Deal, a maximal version, actually looks like? And if you go back to the Ocasio-Cortez marquee resolution in the Congress, there's a few words that I just think are, you know, I don't know why parties in Canada couldn't say something like this, but this makes it clear what we're talking about. And let me just read this little bit. They talk about the Green New Deal must ensure the use of democratic and participatory processes that are inclusive of and led by frontline and vulnerable communities and workers to plan, implement, and administer the Green New Deal mobilization at the local level. So that's, you know, it's policy language, it's in a resolution, but it really gives you a picture of what it might look like to have a more democratic process that involves more people. It's messier, it's kind of more politically dangerous, but it feels way more like the society-wide mobilization that all of these politicians are trying to invoke. One more example, the Bernie Sanders Green New Deal plan that came out a few weeks ago, I think is just a stunning document. And its very third bullet point, I'm just going to read it because it's short, and it gives an exact, this is nowhere in anywhere in any of the Green Party platform commitments, and they make their commitment in their introductory words. They say, we will meet or exceed anything in any Green New Deal vision, whether in Canada or the United States. So here's a throwdown. I'd like to hear something like this from anyone in Canada. Bernie Sanders talks about the need to directly invest an historic $16.3 trillion public investment, $16 trillion, towards these efforts, in line with the mobilization of resources made during the New Deal in World War II, but with an explicit choice to include Black, Indigenous, and other minority communities who were systematically excluded in the past. That's a statement, a moral statement, a political statement, a historic reality that gets embedded in the political platform. And we're not seeing that in the Green Party platform.
Well, we don't see anything from the Greens about a coherent ideology. Like, that's what's so infuriating, is they have no ideological core. And that thing you were saying earlier about, you know, the Greens like saying, like, we're from the grassroots. Like, that's, I just want to keep saying, like, that's not what the grassroots means. If you have someone yelling racist, weird stuff in the back, you're not just like, oh, one of us. You're kind of like, someone go talk to that guy. That seems kind of problematic. And, like, this whole thing about a clear ideology and, like, saying whatever people want to hear is really true for me about what her comments on abortion recently, which were horrifying. And I'm sure were horrifying for a lot of other people. Like, being interviewed on CBC, Elizabeth May basically says, you know, I would never stop one of my members from, like, providing a private member's bill to reopen the abortion debate, which is completely out of sync with, like, other things she said, and then not out of sync with things she said in, like, 2006, where she told a group of nuns, like, oh, I would never encourage women to get abortions. I've discouraged many women. Like, you can't just say words to people. And if you're the leader of a federal party, you better believe that you're expected to be publicly leading based on a firm ideological core of what your morals and values are as a party. And you have to be expected to defend your stance and to encourage people to be better.
I think, you know, I think you're, this is totally fair. And I honestly, it's a little disingenuous to say I'm just this chief spokesperson. I mean, yeah. Elizabeth has been the only Green MP. She's the leader of the party, whatever. The Green Party does have a very democratic structure, and I think it's laudable. But the leader is the leader. And for most voters in Canada, I think Elizabeth May is the Green Party. That's just a political reality. She's been the face of it for a very long time. And there is this sort of, there's a kind of Canadian political zealot quality of she is a different person in every photograph. That she knows her audiences really well, and she speaks in a very different way to different audiences, as if social media or even traditional media didn't exist and we wouldn't all find out and then have to reconcile it with other stuff. So, you know,
when
will
things
the
get awkward, you can't just be like, I sometimes eat lunch here, I don't know everybody. That's ridiculous.
Okay, so that's we're going to share the will the Green Party, will the real Green Party please stand up and stay standing and just say what you mean. What else were you feeling listening to the interview?
I just, like, the last thing that really just drives me up the wall is Elizabeth May really throwing at it, like, oh, I've been to a lot of climate talks, and, like, I know what goes on there, and, like, that's why I'm firm on climate, which is, if you've been, like, I have been to multiple UN climate talks with Elizabeth May, mm-hmm. and we're still talking about, in all these meetings, I would say, like, a huge amount of the conversations that happen, the panels are about, like, what is climate debt? What is distressed migration? How are we talking about, you know, protecting the global south? Where does racial justice come into play here? What does paying your fair share mean? And if she goes to the climate talks and comes forward with this climate platform and is still completely devoid of a justice lens, that just means to me that she's showing up to these talks and only listening to half.
Well, I think, again, she's made a commitment, or the party has made a commitment in its platform to meet or exceed anything that's out there in terms of Green New Deal policy. And again, going back to the Bernie Sanders platform, which is a stunning political document, mm-hmm. High in the document, they really outline for the first time in memory, in ever, in a political document, actually what climate debt means and what it looks like. Let me just read one more thing. He makes a commitment to meeting and exceeding our fair share of global emissions reductions. The United States has, for over a century, spewed carbon pollution emissions into the atmosphere in order to gain economic standing in the world. Therefore, we have an outsized obligation to help less industrialized nations meet their targets while improving quality of life. So it goes on to commit to reducing domestic emissions by 71% by 2030, and reducing emissions among less industrialized nations with hundreds of billions of dollars of contributions, hard financial transfers to less industrialized countries to help them reduce their emissions, which means a total emissions reductions of more than 100% from a rich country like the United States. There's no Canadian political party that has anything like that in a platform, and we must have it if we want to have a Green New Deal or a climate plan that actually deserves the name.
And if Elizabeth May is claiming that the Green Party is ready for that, and they cannot introduce a stunning proposal for climate policy while simultaneously neither confirming nor denying that women, racialized people, marginalized people, people victimized by hate will be protected or defended by the party, they need to get it together.
So, one thing we didn't talk about is the way Elizabeth May talked about the Greens who have challenged her and the federal party platform on its position on tar sands development. I mean, that seems significant in a story that's not getting play.
Oh, big time. Yeah, I thought it was interesting that one of the provincial Green parties actually considers itself eco-socialist, which is totally wild. Mm-hmm. Because everyone in Canada seems to have really different ideas about what the Greens are, who they are, based on where they are regionally. And so what does eco-socialism actually mean in Quebec? And who's this guy that Elizabeth May is slamming on our podcast? So I thought, let's call and ask him. So here's my conversation with Alex Terrell, the leader of the Green Party of Quebec. So, Alex, we've spoken with Elizabeth May on Mission Possible and Vision Green. So instead, let's maybe go right into who you are as the Quebec Greens and what and where the need for your petition, Green Rising, came from.
Yeah, so my name is Alex Turrell. I'm the leader of the Green Party of Quebec. I've been leading the party for almost 6 years now. And the Green Party of Quebec really represents the left wing of the Canadian Green movement. So we're the only Green Party in Canada that identifies ourselves as eco-socialist. We've got the youngest team. And we're really the progressive side of it. So earlier this year, when Elizabeth May released her Mission Possible plan, it included provisions to build refineries in order to refine the tar sands oil in Canada, and also for energy independence. So she was talking about using this tar sands oil for the Canadian market and even moving it into Quebec. And at that point, I had criticized it a little bit through the media. And it was a little bit difficult to get things to move, so we started a petition called greensrising.ca, and it's basically calling on her to take a strong position against the Alberta tar sands ahead of the next election. So what we're asking for is a commitment that if the Green Party would win the election, that the tar sands would be shut down in the first mandate.
Okay. So specifically with regards to expansion of the tar sands, Elizabeth May says that you haven't read the Green platform clearly and that they're only allowing for existing upgrade projects that have already started to go forward. So what is your response to that?
Right. So, I mean, look, I'm a left-wing activist within the Green Party, and we know that the Green Party has sort of been traditionally a coalition of left and right, and the Green Party of Quebec and myself, we have a very open agenda to move this party to the left and to become more radical on certain environmental questions. And so, unfortunately, Elizabeth May has decided to turn to somewhat personal attacks to try and discredit me, to say that I hadn't read the platform, things like that. Look, I have a degree in environmental science. I wrote the first draft of most of the Green Party of Quebec's platform. I've studied all the Green Party platforms in the country. And so I really find it's unfortunate that instead of admitting that there is a difference of opinion within the Green Party, which is completely normal because it is sort of a left-right coalition, that she's turned to these sort of personal attacks.
All right. Well, let's go big picture for a second. So your party, the Quebec Greens, are calling itself an eco-socialist party. So what does that mean? And why do you think eco-socialism is necessary to solve the climate crisis?
Yeah, so there's emerging consensus within the environmental movement that the struggle for social justice and environmental protection are inherently linked and inseparable. And so that's the ideology that we're subscribing to in the Green Party. And eco-socialism, it's a question of taking care of the environment, but also making sure that we take care of the population at the same time, making sure that everybody can have access to quality health care, that we can have a free education for everybody, regardless of their means to pay, and that we can really build a comprehensive social safety net to make sure that everybody's taken care of in our society. It's also about fighting racism and discrimination. In Quebec, we've been very outspoken against Bill 21 banning religious symbols or really any kind of legislation that removes constitutional rights or impacts minority groups in a negative way. A piece of legislation that suspends provisions of the Canadian Constitution, which guarantees freedom of religion, and it makes it so that what people that they call in positions of authority, such as judges, police officers, and even school teachers, won't be allowed to wear any kind of religious symbol, whether it's a hijab, a turban, a kippah, at work. And so it puts people in a very difficult position where they're forced to choose between their religion and their job, and it's, in my opinion, it's completely unacceptable to put people in front of that that choice, and their constitutional rights and freedoms should be protected.
Mm-hmm. So are the Quebec Greens planning not only in, you know, making statements that, you know, they don't support it, but are you planning on working with anybody to fight it? Is there any plans to work in community for that? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. So we've been active in the different communities, particularly the Muslim community, that's very well mobilized in Quebec to fight back against this legislation. But it's not just the Muslim community. There's a lot of other communities, and there's a lot of allies who are there standing up for everybody's rights and freedoms. And for us at the Green Party of Quebec, that's what's really important, is making sure that people's rights and freedoms are protected. And, you know, we're very critical of this use of the notwithstanding clause to suspend those rights. And we're even calling for a constitutional reform that we can really look at. Should we actually have this this notwithstanding clause that can allow a provincial government to suspend all kinds of rights that should be guaranteed under the Constitution?
The establishment Green Party, the Federal Greens, have made very clear that they are not eco-socialist. In fact, the federal slogan is, of course, not left, not right, but forward together. So can you break down a little bit the conservatism that you're calling to combat in the federal green landscape?
Right. So what we're calling for is to really rebuild the Green Party of Canada around left-wing principles and values. But the problem that we have right now is that despite the fact that we have this large coalition of left and right, we don't really have that much internal debate or democracy, and the position at the end of the day is more or less decided by the leader's office. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to mobilize progressive individuals from both inside and outside the Green Party to come together and to help us build this Green Party of Canada into the next vehicle for the Canadian left. And I firmly believe that the Green Party is the most viable vehicle for the Canadian left, because myself, I used to be in the NDP up until Thomas Mulcair won the leadership. And there's a huge establishment in the NDP, and it's very much centrist, and they're unwilling to do things like speak out against fracking, call for a national ban on fracking. Jagmeet Singh, we've seen him flip-flopping on the pipelines, on LNG. And so the NDP, I think, is a party that's run its course. It's very old now. And the Green Party, on the other hand, is a much smaller organization, and it's really got a lot of wind in its sails. It's taking off all over the world. There's an international network of Green Parties, and there are a lot of progressive people there. I mean, you know, don't forget that in 2016, the membership voted overwhelmingly in support of boycott, divestment, and sanction against Israel, something that no other Canadian political party has ever done. And so despite the fact that obviously Elizabeth May didn't support that, and There were efforts to roll it back. It shows that the membership of the Green Party is actually very progressive.
You know, we have Elizabeth May. She's saying, she told Avi in the interview previous that she is simply a spokesperson who doesn't really hold any power. What do you have to say to that?
Right. Okay. Well, I disagree with that. I think that Elizabeth May has a tremendous amount of power and influence within the Green Party of Canada. That's the way that I've seen it over the past 6 years that I've been here. And look, there is an establishment within the Green Party, right? Elizabeth May does have a very strong circle around her that supports what she's doing. She has a lot of support in the party, but there are a lot of people that want to see it go to the left. And, you know, the fact is also that Elizabeth has been the leader of the party for 13 years now, and we don't know when it's going to happen, but there will be renewal one day in the Green Party of Canada leadership. And what we're trying to do with this Green Rising group is to really bring progressives together, bring left-wing Green Party people together so that should that happen in the next 5 or 10 years, who knows how long it's going to be, that at least there'll be a solid network of left-wing people within the Green Party of Canada who are ready to bring this party to the left, to get really strongly progressive leadership in place. And I think that the Green Party is the best vehicle for this because the Canadian left is searching for a party, you know. And for a long time, it was the NDP, but we've seen that the NDP is in decline, that they're having a lot of trouble, that, you know, year after year, people go to the convention, they try to get left-wing policies in there, they get voted down, there's a whole party establishment. I've been to 4 NDP conventions myself as a member, and it's very difficult. The Green Party, on the other hand, is much smaller. It's more accessible. And the Green Party of Quebec has put itself back on the map as an eco-socialist party. We're standing against the religious discrimination. We're standing for social justice, against the privatization of the hospital systems, for free public transit, and for a lot of different things that really resonate with the Canadian left. And I think that, you know, the left in general in Canada has really neglected political parties as a tactic. And you know, and I can understand why some people don't want to be involved and they see it's part of the system and stuff like that, but it is important.
If we're talking about appealing to the Canadian left, I have to ask about what's going on in New Brunswick.
Right. Well, look, I was concerned when I read those kind of things, but you know, after looking into it, it's not the case. I think that really what's happening is that the NDP is in free fall, and Jagmeet Singh is lashing out at the Green Party out of desperation. Because if you look at what the people said, they said that yes, it is difficult, you know, to convince people in rural New Brunswick that the next Prime Minister of Canada is going to be somebody who wears a turban. Now, it's not because you know that. It might be difficult, that it's impossible. What they were saying is that the minimum to be able to do that would be that Jagmeet would have to come to New Brunswick, visit the people, and make a good impression on them. And in 2 years of leadership, he never set foot there. But us in the Green Party of Quebec, we've had a very strong party line against any kind of religious discrimination. And, you know, we watch those things very, very carefully, you know. So there is also a... you know, as the Green Party goes forward and becomes more and more sophisticated, well, there's more and more vetting of candidates and stuff like that. And if you want to have a truly sustainable party, the ideological foundation has to be solid. It's one thing to have this huge left-right coalition when nobody's in power and we're getting 3-4% of the vote. But now, once people are starting to win, some of these divisions might come through a little bit more. And that's another reason why it's important in the coming years to have a left-right debate within the Green Party and say, okay, where is it that we're going? Where do we want to position ourselves? Because there's a lot of questions that are going to come up.
And that debate feels so urgent right now. And so the last kind of question we want to end on is, do you believe, as currently constituted, can the Green Party bring about a Green New Deal that's worthy of the name?
Look, I think that there's a huge amount of possibilities for the Green Party. And I mean, I do agree with 90% of their platform, especially on environment. But, you know, there are certain things that could be improved. I think the party could step to the left. It should step to the left. It should embrace eco-socialism and the Green New Deal. But there's a little bit of work to do. And I'm not going to pretend that all that work can be done before October 19th, but I think that the Green Party is the most viable vehicle for the Canadian left, and should people choose to become invested in this party, then there's a lot of things that we can accomplish together. And that's why I'm really calling on all progressives from all over Canada to join the Green Party, to become members of it, to come to the policy conventions, and to help us really build this party into the party of the Canadian left.
Perfect. Thank you so much for coming, Alex, and joining us on the podcast. And good luck with what's coming up next.
Thanks.
Maya, you weren't making fun of Alex, were you? Just there? Good luck with what's...
I'm actually going through a tunnel. Can't hear you. Sorry. Bad signal.
But I mean, these are interesting times. People who are engaging with electoral politics from outside are talking about party takeovers, you know, openly. Obviously, none of that happens during an election campaign, or frankly, right after. If there's a majority government, it'll be a rebuilding phase. There might be, you know, new dynamics. But in a minority government, everyone's going to be focused on what's happening in the House of Commons. I don't know. I'm a little weary of the takeover, the easy takeover talk.
Why?
Well, I mean, it may ultimately be necessary to have a genuinely left electoral vehicle in Canada. But initially, nobody's going to take over a party tomorrow. People first have to engage good faith with the parties as they are. And then, you know, when all else fails, try to kind of do a momentum UK takeover. But I just feel like we're a ways from that. And in the meantime, we want to influence these parties as we have already by getting the Green New Deal on the table, as flawed as the various visions are. And we want to maintain that influence during and after the election. And talk and takeover is not something that political parties love. So I just feel like there are stages, you know, lots of stages.
Yeah, and none of those stages include Winston Churchill.
So about that... We will fight them on the beaches. We will fight them on Facebook. I feel like the wartime mobilization metaphor is really important. It deserves a longer conversation. I think that the way Elizabeth May started this show with it is exactly wrong. Invoking colonial monsters like Churchill is not mm-hmm. the value of a wartime metaphor. The value, in fact, particularly in Canada, is that during the Second World War, the government really took charge of the economy, planned it, and executed an economic restructuring where corporations had to do what they were told to serve a greater purpose. And that's the model that we need. That's the value of the wartime metaphor. But now I'm just getting off on one of my hobby horses. Maya, what did you think of your interview with Alex?
I think that Alex's response to, I was really kind of like disappointed by his response to what's going on with the state of racism right now. Mm-hmm. Because there's two big problems I'm seeing here. Like, one, for example, with what's going on in New Brunswick, and like Alex and Elizabeth talked about this, but we need to be able, like, we should be able to critique the fact that like Jagmeet didn't even go there. Like, that's a problem. Yep. 100%. Yep. You have to visit the Maritimes. That's one problem. Jagmeet didn't even visit. The second thing is that there's very blatant runaway racism all over there. And those are separate issues, but we have to be able to talk about both of them.
Yeah, like political strategy versus the Canadian shield of racism that undergirds the country.
The Canadian shield of racism.
They're different subjects. Different subjects.
But this fear of addressing them head on, like addressing racism and addressing fascism head on, it's got to go. Like, it makes all these arguments weaker. And the success of the Green New Deal really at its core is about whether or not we have the strong enough foundations to address all of these things at once. It demands that we do it that way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then it's time, as we wind up the episode, to answer the question we set out with. I'm going to put it to you. Can the Green Party of Canada, as currently constituted, actually put forward a Green New Deal that is worthy of the name, Maya?
I'm going to say a hard no, sad exclamation point.
We get emojis in our answers now? No, I think I do agree. I also feel like we need to continue to influence political parties. And the Green Party is after, they're the new cool kids. They're the popular kids. And they're definitely showing up to prom, Maya, unlike you.
Oh my gosh. So they'll just get an award just for showing up? That's super sad. Oh. Hopefully people are thinking a little bit more critically about what they've done to deserve this prestigious prom award. You know, maybe we need better awards. If we want to give one to the Green Party, what would it be?
Okay. Party most likely to throw its web guys under the bus if they underperform at the polls. That's it.
This episode of Change Everything was project managed by Rajiv Sikora and edited and mixed by Jeremy Kessler. Change Everything was developed with Andreas Schmidt at What Escapes Production.
Thanks to our guests Elizabeth May and Alex Terrell for their Change Everything style mobilization. An extra special thanks for serial techno salvation to Andrew Peters. Our theme music is by Aluma Music.